This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
What an honor to host Toni Morrison tonight, and also what a treat for me personally to have on stage my friend and one of our nation's finest journalists, Michelle Norris. I know that I'm sure all of you are looking forward to their discussion about Ms. Morrison's new novel, God Help the Child. Who knows, with the two of them, they may go off and cover a lot of other things too. We'll have to wait and see. And I did want to say that unless you've been living on another planet for most of the past half century, you know that Toni Morrison is a literary icon. She began her career in publishing. She was for many years a professor of literature and writing. She's published novels, works of nonfiction, books for children. She's written a play, song lyrics, and a libretto for an opera. And along the way, she's won a Nobel Prize, a Pulitzer Prize, and just about every other literary prize. Now, that may sound like enough for one career, but let me just add one other very important thing, in case that's not enough. She has been a vocal, unambiguous, and unwavering champion of free speech, and I just want to personally, as a bookstore owner, thank you for that, too. So. God Help the Child is her 11th novel, and when you read it, you may find some echoes of her earlier works. Once again, she dares the reader to go headfirst, eyes wide open, into the often raw and uncomfortable terrain of familial bonds and burdens of race, color, identity, love, and violence. Just a few days ago, Michelle and I were talking about the book, having both read it, and she said, "Boy, it sure packs a punch." Well, I think that's about as good a summation as I've heard. And speaking of Michelle, many of you know her as host and special correspondent on NPR's All Things Considered. She's won very distinguished prizes for both print and broadcast journalism. And having been her editor way back in the day when she was a young reporter, I can say without reservation that she is simply the best the profession has to offer. I hope you've all heard NPR's reports from the Race Card Project, which she founded and which has turned into a global and much-needed conversation about race. She's also an author. She wrote a wonderful memoir called The Grace of Silence, and she's currently a Shorenstein Fellow at Harvard. Now, as an admirer of both Toni Morrison and Michelle Norris, I'm going to go out on a limb and take a liberty here and suggest the following, that Michelle is special as a journalist in some of the same ways that Toni Morrison is special as a writer. Both of these women are simply unsatisfied with the superficial, convenient, and easy explanations of the world's paradoxes, contradictions, conflicts, and complexities. They plumb the depths of the human experience, and in so doing, they give us a greater window on our own lives, our own world, and certainly on the human condition. I think we can all thank them for that, and please join me in welcoming Toni Morrison and Michelle Norris.
I think we all know that we're in for a special evening. And it feels appropriate that we are in a sanctuary. I'd like to begin, if you wouldn't mind, with a reading. Would that be okay?
Sure. Yeah. I've been reading off and on for the last 2 or 3 days. And
do you want to tell us a little bit about the section that you've chosen to read?
I've been reading the opening, you know, and then I thought, I don't want to read that again. And then I was looking for something fresh. Anyway, as a little introduction, there's some major people in the book. One is a girl whose name was Luann Bride, and she got a very fashionable job, changed her name to Bride. then there's a man whose name is Booker, but he's not in this section. This is her transformation, mental as well as physical, from being what her mother insisted she was, which was ugly and very, very, very black. And the mother, of course, is light enough to pass. But what she heard, she's sort of pretty under all that black. Neighbors and their daughters agreed. Sweetness, her mother, never attended parent-teacher meetings or volleyball games. I was encouraged to take business courses, not the college track, community college, instead of four-year state universities. I didn't do any of that. After I don't know how many refusals, I finally got a job working stock. Never sales, where customers would see me. I wanted the cosmetics counter, but didn't dare ask for it. I got to be a buyer only after rock dumb white girls got promotions or screwed up so bad they settled for somebody who actually knew about stock. Even the interview at Sylvia Inc. got off to a bad start. They questioned my style, my clothes, and told me to come back later. That's when I consulted Jerry. Then, walking down the hall toward the interviewer's office, I could see the effect I was having. Wide, admiring eyes, grins, and whispers, "Whoa! Oh, baby!" In no time, I rocketed to regional manager. "See," said Jerry, "black sells. It's the hottest commodity in the civilized world. White girls, even brown girls, have to strip naked to get that kind of attention." True or not, it made me, remade me. I began to move differently, not a strut, not that pelvis out rush of the runway, but a stride, slow and focused. Men leaped, and I let myself be caught. For a while anyway, until my sex life became sort of like Diet Coke. Deceptively sweet, minus nutrition. More like a PlayStation game, imitating the safe glee of virtual violence and just as brief. All my boyfriends were typecast, would-be actors, rappers, professional athletes, players waiting for my crotch or my paycheck like an allowance. Others, already having made it, treating me like a medal, a shiny, quiet testimony to their prowess. Not one of them giving helpful, none interested, none of them giving helpful, none interested in what I thought, just what I looked like, joking or baby talking me through what I believed was serious conversation before they found more ego props elsewhere. Then him, Booker, Booker Starburn.
That was Bride describing herself and her life. And when you said that she's really black, what you meant by that is that she's not just culturally black. She is very dark.
Physically. blue-black. As her mother says, Sudanese, black. Aboriginal. She has all the words.
But her mother has other words also, because her mother and her father are both fair-skinned.
Very fair.
They can't figure out how this happened.
They what?
Can't figure out how this happened, how the ancestors reached tapped their child in some way. And if you were confused by hearing sweetness, Bride never calls her mother mother.
Her mother won't let her, no.
She calls her sweetness.
Her mother said it would be too strange to have this really, really black child call her mama. It would confuse people, she said. Or mother, so she makes her call her sweetness, which she does. It's a very traumatic childhood for this little girl. The mother not only feeling upset about this throwback, but feels that her best service to her daughter is to protect her, so she won't be snubbed. Don't talk back to the teachers, you get thrown out. Don't get in a fight, keep your head down because you're vulnerable. And so she believes that's the best that she can do. But she never offers her what the little girl craves, which is love.
You said at one point that all of your books begin with a question. What was the question that led you on this journey? What was it that you wanted to know when you started writing this book?
You know, I started this book before I wrote and published the last book, Home, because I couldn't get a hold on the world that's more contemporary than the ones I usually write about. I had written a book that took place in the 80s, but it was off in a jungle somewhere in the Caribbean, so I didn't have to think about, much. But I couldn't get a handle on now. In a way, I still can't. For example, we were saying last night, do you remember some parent in New York was arrested or threatened with having her children taken away because they were walking alone in Central Park?
That was here in, right outside Washington, D.C.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that, and then I thought about how when we were kids, all they said was go outside and play.
Right, and all don't come back until dinner time.
And don't come back. So those wild differences were problematic for me. So I skipped it. Then I went back. Then I realized, to answer your question, that what really hadn't changed was color. You know, what we think or what the media, the noise is about color, meaning race or racism or what have you. But it was entirely like and unlike the first book I wrote, mm-hmm. The Bluest Eye, in which a vulnerable little black girl feels so awful and so picked upon because of her color. And she craves blue eyes. And she thinks that will make all the difference. She thinks, it was a real incident, in fact. This has got to be the worst plastic glass in the history
of plastic glasses. It's the worst ever.
This is worse. It's like paper. You know?
Can we get a glass?
Sorry about that. Did you pick yours up?
I haven't. I'm just gonna
don't touch it.
Leave it there.
I'm sorry about that little housekeeping.
But you were saying that...
I was saying that this child... It was an incident. You know, when I was about 10 years old, my very best friend was a girl. And we were having a quarrel about the presence of God. And I said he existed and so on. She said he didn't, and we were going back and forth. Then she stopped me. She said she had proof that God didn't exist. The proof of which was, she said, she had prayed for blue eyes for 2 years, and he hadn't delivered. So I remember looking at her thinking two things. One, she would be awful looking if he had done it. I thought she would be really awful. That's the first thing I thought. The second thing was, she was so beautiful. And at, you know, at that age, at 10, you don't think of beauty. You think cute or something. But this was really startling. It was almost like a piece of art. You know, she had high cheekbones and a narrow nose, these huge almond eyes. And it was sort of startling, both of those things. But the book, for those of you who don't know it, is about how that and the neighborhood really destroy her. You know, that kind of contempt. And so by the time I got to really thinking about what I would do with God Help the Child was to alter it. I mean, Jerry calls her a panther in snow. And that she should wear white all the time. And, you know, he makes her beauty, which is there, aggressive. And it works. She gets good jobs. Everybody loves her. She got these boyfriends, you know, sort of. And then finally she falls in love with somebody who really loves her. So it's a combination, but it seemed to me that that subtext was very much present. Mm-hmm. You know, it's underneath.
So some things had changed, but some things
had not. And the language is all wrong about discussing it, you know. You know, we know race doesn't exist. I mean, there's the human race, period. And then there's racism, which is something that we invent and hang on to, make money from, and categorize each other. And that social construction, you know, holds sway in some places. Nobody comes out of the womb saying, I hate Chinese people, or I hate black people, or... That is something you learn, which means it has to be taught. You either accept it or you don't. So that is part of the discourse of now, even when a couple of years ago, you know, right after I started this, you had this campaign for Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And that didn't play into it that much, but it was certainly there. The color thing. So I thought that was an argument, or at least a scene or a plateau out of which a book could come. But the point was, even though she becomes this really, really gorgeous, really, really beautiful black woman, you just can't rest on that. You gotta be something more than that. Pretty. I mean, it may feel like it's enough for all of you who are beautiful. But it's not. You have to be a... You have to be a real three-dimensional person, which means whatever your trauma and your little bad little thing happened, you have to get over it. Oh, first of all, what happens here is they take care of somebody else. Somebody they really like, both of them, the man and the boy. And they forgot the thing that was strangling them. And then, after that loss, you know, they are like two people. Each complicated, each interesting, but they could be together now. And they live happily ever after, except for Sweetness, who says, yeah, well.
I did my best.
Don't worry about it. When you become a parent, you change. The world changes. Everything changes. It's a different life.
You have said interesting things about that. You said that when you became a parent, it was liberating.
It was for me, yeah. When I became a parent, I didn't have to... I didn't have to be good looking, because my kids could care less. I didn't have to be sexy. I didn't have to be... What they wanted from me was something I could deliver, which was honesty, capability, something to eat, and something to say. And I could do that. That was liberating. I didn't have to adjust to the institutional world or the world of the male world of publishing. I have to tell you a little story, then we'll get back to it. I was in a school book, textbook company when I left Howard University, and I had two small kids. One baby was, I don't think he was 2 years old. Anyway, I was working at this place, and they gave out the raises. Everybody got a raise. And I figured out, or asked somebody, somebody told me, some guy in the company, he got more than I got. I don't know, $15, $20 more than me. And we had the same job. So I went into the head guy, the chief, and said, you paid the men more than you did me. And he said, yes, but they're head of household. And I said, excuse me, you're head of household? Don't give me that divorce, mother, children, black stuff. I'm head of household, just like you. So he did. He gave me, but that, you know, I could never have done that otherwise. You know, there's a certain amount of moxie or aggression under the circumstances that you get. A friend of mine told me, a young man who just had a young son, and his wife and he came to visit, and he said that he drives differently. He drives his car differently. It means he goes slower, he pays attention, you know, he's not running. And he sees things, you know, things that might... Yeah. Interfere differently. So it's a different perception. So that's really what the mother, Sweetness, is saying, although she's giving them a little bit of credit, but she says, yeah, well, God help the child.
When you become a mother, your gaze at the world is different. You see things through your child's eyes, and you also see the world in terms of what it might do for your child or to your
child.
That's
right, that's right.
And I wonder if that worked its way into your writing as a mother, now as a grandmother, because at the center of many of these stories are trauma, and trauma inflicted on people who are vulnerable, often children, and inflicted on children at the hands of people who should be there to protect them instead.
Mm-hmm. I'm very keenly aware of that. But I think what happened was work, parenting. I remember sitting down in the office with a yellow pad, writing down everything I had to do, everything. not just write this review, but do something for my sister or my this. And it was a long, long list. And then on the other side, I decided to write what I must do, had to do. And there were only two things. Mother my children and write books. And that's all. And everything on that long list that didn't contribute to those two things, I scratched off. If I had agreed to do a book review or something, that was helpful because A, I got money for it, and that would help my children. B, would help my writing skills. It was simple. I just went like that. No, yes, no. If it worked for those two things. It was a kind of a paring down. And that's part of the freedom that I felt. You know, I mean, I did all these other things, but they were not important. You know, they could fire me if they wanted to.
But thank goodness they didn't.
They didn't, but...
Why did you choose the title, God Help the Child? And why in this book did you choose to explore the vestiges of fractured motherhood? What happens when there's poison in the well and how... An adult never really gets over that. They're always chasing something that wasn't there for them.
Yeah, that's a serious pain. The absence of... you know, you can hover over your children, but they call them helicopter mothers. Or you can, like, let them stroll down the street by themselves and so on. Those roles are changing so much because... the society is. But those huge, you know, sustained horrors that you can experience before you're 12, hang on. The man in the book has a brother. He's like this with his brother. And the brother gets kidnapped and molested and murdered. And he never gets over that. And he runs around beating up people he thinks are seducing children and so on. Although he's an educated man, he comes from a good family. That determines everything, all his actions, what he believes, and he can't leave it. So they both have what they feel, something terrible happened when they were young and helpless and could not do anything about it. So whatever else they do, become the most beautiful woman in the world or become the most educated man in the world, they still have this thing until they confront this woman, queen, who says, you know, you're going to let that hang over your head and freeze your heart and sit in your brain forever? You know, she was trying to say, you're allowing yourself to be chained by this little story that you know the theme, you know the plot, you know everything, and that's all you're going to hang on to. And it will bind you and, you know, distort your life. The original title, which everybody hated, except me, was called The Wrath of Children.
The Wrath of Children.
W-R-A-T-H. And everybody, agents, editors, publishers, friends, everybody said, oh my God. That's horrible, Tony. I thought it was perfect. But anyway. I did the version of the song, you know. God bless the child.
Yes.
And I just moved that verb. And I had it, and I put it in the right person's mouth. If she hadn't spoken at the end, you know, whatever else you're doing, you know, look out. Everything changes. Good luck.
If you have not read this book, you need to dive in. And like many of your books, you read it and then this is a smaller book. you want to go back and read it again.
Mm.
You sort of need to go back front to, because there are things that you'll catch the second time. You noted that you were writing your list on a yellow legal pad. You write your books.
I'm doing a little bit less because I'm joining the world of computers. I used to say I could always tell when my students created their stories on the computer.
How could you tell?
Because it was too much. You know, it looks so good when you, type on a computer and print it out. It's neat. It has margins. Things are spelled right because you have spell check. And I said, why are you going on? You know, it's not edited. I can feel the puffery. But I have never, only this last time have I don't really create on the computer. I can't do that. And I still write with my hand with a number two pencil on a yellow pad and scratch out things and turn pages and so on. And after that's done, I put it on a computer, print it out, then write on top of that.
Okay.
Write on top of that. Then do back and forth. But the energy and the clarity only comes if I write, not when I invent on a keyboard.
You don't like them. Your face changes when you do this.
Did my face change?
Yes.
You know, I asked my son, he said, what do you want for Christmas? And I said, I want a typewriter.
Ooh.
And he found me a typewriter. Because, you know, in high school, I used to be like the world's best typewriter. But you know, on a computer, you have this little light, flat keyboard. Typewriter, you have to get serious, you know. And you have to use your little finger, you know what I mean? Nobody does that anymore. My son types like this.
Hunt and peck?
Yeah, 2, 4 fingers. Anyway.
That's where do you write?
I have a little room, an office on the river. I live in Grandview, and I write there.
And you look out at the water when
No.
Oh.
That's too seductive. You know, my desk is here, looking out on some grass and bushes and whatever. The river's over there. I would never stare at it when I'm writing because it's distracting.
Mm.
You know, besides it makes you think you're doing something you're not. You know, just stay with the stuff. The only time that worked was in Beloved. Because I have to say this, I know it sounds lunatic, but I was trying to think, who is the best person? I don't know if you know that story, but it was about this woman who killed her children, tried to kill them all, killed one so they wouldn't go back into slavery. And I was thinking, and some people said, oh, it's terrible. The abolitionists wanted her tried for murder because that meant she was responsible for her child. And the slave owners wanted her tried for theft because she stole their property. So there was this big debate and so on. And some said yes, some said no. And I thought the best person to say whether she was right or wrong would be the dead child. So I had this thought, maybe I could fix a way. And then I was looking out the window, the river's over there. And I swear to you, sober. I am always sober. I saw this, imagine this figure coming out of the water, coming up on the grass, and sitting down on one of the rocks. And she had on clothes, which is what I wrote in Beloved, and let her do whatever she wanted to do, love her mother or kill her, one of the two. I'm sure she felt both. But those little tricky little magical little vision sights can't come very seldom, if at all. I think I've had it like one other time. But the rest of it is really just pencil, paper, working it out, taking it apart. but I have to hear it. You know, for me, a lot of it's just
sound. You talk out loud when you write.
No.
No, because many writers do. They speak out loud when they write. You don't do that.
I don't talk, but I hear it. I hear it so clearly. You know, I have, in the beginning, there were requests for audiobooks, and I said, yes, fine. And two of them were done by very good actresses, and I never listened to them because I knew what was in the book. So, but then one I listened to, and this is someone, an actress whom I absolutely adore as well as admire, but when I heard her reading, I said, that's not right. The rhythm was wrong. 124 was spiteful, boom, full of a baby's venom, boom. She was reading that straight through. I thought, no. So for me, a lot of it is the way it sounds. And I think I'm hoping that the sound of it as well as the text is as seductive to the reader as it is to me. You know, I mean, I just want you to come on in, work with me on this, hear this, and so on.
We're going to take audience questions in just a minute, but it's clear that you have a rhythm and a cadence in what you do. It's clear when you read it. It's clear when we hear you read it. It was clear when you took the sip from the old glass of water and stopped at a very opportune moment and then picked up. It was there was a syncopation even to that. And you have a beautiful voice. I wonder if at some point before you became a writer, if you considered becoming a performer, using your voice in a different way, singing, performing on stage.
No. My mother had the most beautiful voice in the world. She could sing anything, jazz, spirituals, classical, and she sang all the time. So you think I'm going there? No. No. But the other thing was living in a house where people told stories all the time. The adults told stories, and then they would tell us, you tell that story about blah, blah, blah. And we would tell the story, edit it a little bit. Also, I was a radio child. You know, listen to the radio. And so all of that singing and storytelling, and you have to work. When you tell a story that everybody knows all over again, you have to make it interesting. And when the guy on the radio says, you know, the sky is dark, you have to see that. Or if he says there's thunder, you have to hear it. Because you're working with him, because you don't have anything but a voice. So you have to supply all the rest. You have to know what to leave out. So that's part of it. The rest is just is structure and entering into the character. I'll tell you one thing before we stop for questions. Scenes of sex, which I hate when they're clinical, because I assume that the reader's sex is sexier than mine because it's his or hers. So I make it very metaphorical. Somebody's looking underneath in Sula, she's looking underneath skin, going for the alabaster, going for the gold. Or some man told me, I will never, ever eat a cob of corn again after I've read about Setha and her husband in the cornfield. Mm-hmm. No one can see the guys are trying to see, but the corn stalks are waving where they are. And then, you know, you talk about the kernels and the sugar and the hair. but you connect it with, you know. So that's just one area in which I really do insist on making it imaginative and intimate for the reader by not, you know, making it clinical, you know, surgical, pornographical, you know, which just makes you want to, well, makes me want to go to sleep when you see, you know, what? So, you know, that's something you have to really work at, you know, in your language in order to produce that, what I hope is serious relationship, lasting relationships with my work. When you were talking about sometimes it's a good idea to go back, I remember once Oprah Winfrey said, you know, I really love your book, but I always have to go back and read a little bit before. And I said, Oprah, that's called reading.
Well, that's a good thing also, because sometimes, you know, you read a sentence, let me read that again. Let me just take that in again. I wanted to ask you about current events, if I could, because the sun is falling, and in a city about 40 miles north, we are wondering what nightfall will bring. And you have mentioned something a few times when people have interviewed you, and you knew that your father carried within him a psychic wound because he saw a lynching. And this year, we have seen a drumbeat of stories across the calendar where we have seen black men lose their lives on screen. We see it on television screens, we see it on small screens, on our cell phones, we see it on our iPads and our computers, and we often see it over and over again, and so do our children. And so if you talk about an individual carrying that kind of wound after seeing something like that, I wonder if that's something that you think about, because you have talked over the years about your concern about young men of color, and their fate in society, and I wonder if that is very present on your mind right now.
Some years ago, I wrote a play called Dreaming Emmett, and it was a young black boy dreaming, literally, believing himself to be Emmett and confronting the people who killed him. The idea, I mean, this is interesting now for one good reason. One is, it really is everywhere, talking about it. It didn't used to be talked about.
It didn't used to be videotaped.
There was no videotape. Nobody was interested. The cops said this, everybody said that. There were no lawyers. It's been going on, you know, going on. Now there is videotape. Now there is conversation. Now there is outrage. And this, what is interesting, among the things that are sad, in addition to the loss of these lives, because I was listening today when they were talking about Freddie Gray and the police have a report, and you were wondering why were they chasing this young man. Once I read that he made eye contact. Then they said he had a switchblade. What does that mean? And there's nobody seen it. They said he reached for something. Anyway, not all this. The point I'm trying to make is the police are, it's not that they're just out of control and they don't even live in the neighborhood and they don't have any connection. They are strikingly cowardly. It's just amazing. You think the, I mean, it's stunning. I know they think the gun is the manly thing. But you shoot somebody running away and you're scared, And you say, I was fearful for my life. Somebody's running from you. And you have the gun or the taser or the what have you. Or somebody calls 911, you get out the car, and there's a 12-year-old kid running around the park. How can you do that? What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? They're badly trained. So I am very grateful that there's a lot of noise. I know the point in the media is property. That's much more important to them than human life. Yes, this is terrible, this child is shot, but look, they're tearing up CVS, or they're tearing up, yeah. And then the community comes out, sweeps it up, puts the stuff back, but all you hear is, oh my God, they bombed, the car's on fire, that this is the, you know what I mean? You could replace the car, or not. But the child, the boy, the man is dead. I don't have any solutions, as you can tell. I just have wonder and not despair, because that's the way evil wins, is when you think, oh my God, this is terrible. Nothing can be done. That is not the way to go inside. It can be painful. It should hurt. It should do that, but you can't despair, because then they've won and you've lost, as well as the person who's lost his life.
That's all I think about it. Let's ask our audience members to make their way to the microphones. As they're making their way, I'm just going to ask a question about Washington, D.C. This is like coming home for you, and you have a glass. What is it like for you to come to D.C.? So much has changed since you... What is it like for you to come back to D.C.? So much has changed. When you go back around Howard University, so much has changed.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
When you come back to D.C., I'm just curious about
your impression. Oh, God, is it different. When I first came here in 1950, you know, they had little wooden signs in the buses, and the back of the buses had little iron, you know, little holes, and they said colored, and you moved them depending on how many white people got on the bus, and they'd go, all right. So I stole one, sent one to my mother.
I hope you still have it.
I hope she does, or at least it's in the house.
Yeah.
No, it's very built. Mm-hmm. You know, neighborhoods are changing rapidly. But that's true everywhere. You know, in New York, it's you can't move. And the prices are... Who are these people with all this money?
Let's bring the audience into the discussion. Let's start right here. Tell us who you are.
Hi, my name is Makeda Weaver. Thank you for being with us tonight. My question is, how do you decide which of your questions to work on and turn into books?
Of the books, which question that's... it's a nagging thing. What happens if? What does this mean? And then I try to answer it, and the answer's always the same, which is the acquisition of knowledge. Whatever they do, go through sickness, illness, whatever, the end of the book, somebody has to know something important that they did not know before. That's it.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Angela Lyons, and my question is, early on in your career, can you share with us when your work was rejected and what happened to that person that rejected it?
The first book I wrote, The Bluest Eye, was rejected about 12 times. And some of them, of the rejectors, who were readers or editors and so on, I think twice I got a letter explaining it. Most of the time I got a postcard saying thanks but no thanks or something short. But then I got a letter once, and I remember one that said, thank you for sending us your work, but, and the but was, it has no beginning, it has no middle, and it has no end. So the trick, of course, is to know that they're wrong and you're right. But I got a lot of rejections. And then something interesting happened with the bluest eye, which is that City College, I think it was, this is the beginning of the feminist movement, decided that every entering freshman had to read a list, a bibliography, of books by women and African-Americans and Mexican, you know, diverse. And among that list was The Bluest Eye. Now, you have to think, every class forever from 1972 has to pick from this list of books, and The Bluest Eye is on it. So it's like the backlist. I never have to write another book.
So forever just has a beautiful ring in that context.
Right. That's something, man.
Good evening. My name is Stephanie Smith. I was curious because at the National Book Festival, I remember you mentioning that you don't write just to write. You only write when there is something to say. Mm-hmm. And so I wondered, in your downtime, what do you spend your time reading?
Different things. Now I'm reading history, and I'm not reading much fiction these days. Mm-hmm. I used to read a lot whenever it came, and I have some books that are unread because some other kinds of things are interesting me, nonfiction. Right. It seems to me, I'm not sure this is true, but why not say it? I can be wrong if I want. Most of the contemporary fiction, when it's very well written, is self-referential. It's all about I mean, literally, right. It's a story of, so it's sort of narrow. Even though it may be deep, it's still, you know, when I tell people this all the time. When I was teaching creative writing the last few years, I was at Princeton, and I would tell those students, listen, I know you have been taught all your life, write what you know. And I am telling you, you don't know anything. So, write what you do not know. Invent something. Create something you could never. You know, my favorite was, there's a young Mexican girl in Austin, Texas. She can't speak English. She works at a restaurant. She's trying to learn. What about her? And they, but to tell the truth, when they were let go and they'd have to write about their girlfriends and their mamas and their whatever, they knocked it out of the park. If you loosen them up. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting exercise. But for me, an idea surfaces and I track it. And I'm in no hurry. I don't have to write. I mean, I like to write, but if it's not there and it's not interesting, you know, I don't track it. It has to be something I don't know something about. And then I can find out, so to speak, in the process.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good evening. My name is Samantha Reed, and I'm really glad you brought up the scene with Seth in the cornfield earlier from Beloved, because I wanted to ask you, you incorporate food in your books in such interesting ways, and I was wondering if you could just speak to that.
It's a great question.
Yeah, I do. Well, it's an expression. It's not just food. I remember writing a scene. Was it Pilate? who did that perfect egg?
Yes.
I mean, you have to know how to boil an egg. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not just irrelevant, irrespective. But I took it seriously, probably because of the many things, particularly books that were historical, I mean, that those are the things that women did. You know, in Paradise, when she cooks this final meal, the domestic things were really what women did and took pride in. So that was part of it. I guess if I was writing in this book, I have Bride thinking about her boyfriend shaving, and she takes his boar's hair brush and dumps it around the soap, and then she does this, and he has a straight razor, and she doesn't know how to handle it, and then she begins to curve these trails into her face, and it look. So I was trying to take, I mean, it's an intimate thing, because it's his and she's doing it, but it's a male thing, you know. Shaving would be his thing, or, you know, his book bag and things like that. And since she's so contemporary, she don't cook nothing. But but the older women in the other eras that I placed them, they would take great pride in, or they would be embarrassed if they couldn't, you know. That's why.
Thank you.
May I just jump in with a question? With when you mentioned Bride doesn't cook anything, when I wondered, Sua was described as sort of a modern woman when you wrote that book. Mm-hmm. Is there a through line from Sua?
There may be. She's kind of hostile, but she hadn't been beat up. She didn't, you know. She was always tough and aggressive, and thought she was wonderful. And had this good friend. I mean, she was, I don't even know if that's vanity, that's something else. When she's, even when she's dying, Sula, mm-hmm. she's still, you know, thinking, yeah, she's the best. Sorry. Yes.
Hi, Ms. Morrison. My name is Claudia Allen. And I've always enjoyed how you engaged God or religion or different things like that. And so I always wanted to ask you, you know, like, are you doing this intentionally? But what the question that's really on my heart right now is, how do you pick the Bible texts that begin each book or the majority of your books?
Oh, they're like other things. I mean, how could I avoid in this one, suffer little children to come unto me? Some things just surface. And the people, characters, not me so much, are deeply religious, or they make, you know, I lived in a house and grew up in a house in which people mix biblical language with slang, yeah. with, you know, the way African Americans just talk is amazing to me. Some of it you can get now in a little rap. But, you know, they were just as much at home with the Bible as they were with the newspaper, as they were with, you know, variations of their own language and their names. You know, I never knew anybody's real name. They all had nicknames. You know, serious ones. Yeah. Some of them were very unpleasant. But their language, it always fascinated me. The mixture of the biblical as well as the secular, as well as the curse words, you know.
Right.
Seamless.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
Hi, my name is Laura Becker. First, I just wanted to thank you so much for being here. I love you and everything you do.
Thank you.
So my question is, I'm a college student right now, and I know you've had a lot of formal education. And you studied at a lot of prestigious schools, and you taught at prestigious schools. I just wanted to know if being in those majority white environments of such prestige and such learning, if they altered your writing in any way, or if they altered your narratives, or if they inspired any of your works.
Being in majority white, mm-hmm. Well, two things. One, I never lived in a black neighborhood. I lived in a little raggedy little steel town. What we all were poor. They were Czech people next door, Polish people next door, black people across the street. And they all went to different churches. There were 4 black churches, I think 7 Catholic churches, you know, Polish, Czech, you know, so on, Mexican. But so I thought the world was like that. There were a number of them. And I never felt privileged because of it or hampered because of it. It was when I first came to this place, Howard University, where I felt profoundly, and I chose it. I should have gone to Oberlin because I lived 7 miles from Oberlin. And I thought, I don't want to go there because my mama will call me up and say, would you come home and do these dishes or something? So I went as far away as I could, and that was Howard University. And it was just a different sort of thing. But I do not write deliberately, carefully, dedicatedly, without the white gaze. Never. And a lot of African-American writers, particularly men, do. They're writing toward the oppressor, you know, telling him what's wrong with him and so on and so on. Once you get that gaze out, the whole world opens up. I just did a play with Peter Sellers, Desdemona. He wanted to do something. He said he would never do Othello. And I said, how come? And he says, too thin. And I said, no, it's not. And I started talking about the girl. Everybody plays her like she's a simpleton or something. And I said, she ran away from home. You know this. So anyway, we did Desdemona. And I said, I will only do it under one circumstance. He said, what? And I said, I have to get rid of Iago. Huh. If he's in the play, nobody can talk. Nobody tells the truth. He's everywhere, dominating everything. If I can get rid of him, then... And he said, fine. So we did. And we put it on. It's still good. You know, but I don't mean that to say that the work is only for African Americans. It's just getting rid of that little critic that's sitting on your shoulder who say, yeah, but what about that? You know, just don't... You know, Tolstoy didn't write for me. I love him. That's the way I want it to feel, you know? I know it always black woman writer, da-da-da-da-da. But the books themselves, whatever their subject, should be accessible.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have one last question.
We have time for 2 more questions.
Okay, good. That way we can at least hear from one fellow.
Hi, I'm Ms. Morrison.
Hi.
I'm such a huge fan. I've been waiting to meet you since I was 12, so I'm super happy.
I'm sorry, you know, I'm not hearing you.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me better now?
That's better.
I was just saying that I'm a huge fan of yours. My name's Kendra. I've been waiting to meet you since I was 12. And in reading everything that you've written, I just see this motif of parent-child protective violence, whether it's killing your child so that they don't go back into slavery, or even with tough love and everything with Bride and Sweetness in the most recent novel. And I'm thinking, is that the best kind of antidote right now until we can kind of dismantle like systemic violence and, you know, institutional violence? Is that kind of like the best option in the interim for protecting children? And yeah.
No, well, I don't like to think in large terms like that. If we all just sort of grow up and take responsibility for children as though we are them, you know, some part of ourselves is still that child, even though now we're responsible. I'm appalled a lot about the murder of children. People throwing them away and stuffing them in cans, and I mean, constant, you know. Maybe that's because of the abortion laws or something. I'm not sure. But it seems to, maybe it's just mentioned more. But I'm not sure I'm answering your question on point. But I don't have, and I would be wary of anyone else who had a very big universal answer to these very complicated questions when everything boils down. I spent a lot of time, was it yesterday or one day, somewhere talking about goodness. And I was saying, you know, I was repeating something I had said to a graduating class, that I wanted them to be happy, and they deserve to be happy, but not to settle for that, because happiness isn't good enough. And I went on later to explain how utterly bored I was with evil. It just wears a little top hat, has a little cape, makes a lot of noise, tap dancing. There's no imagination at all. None. And you just went, oh, yeah. And also more cars jumped off the roof and, you know, in the movies and stuff. And there's a little blood. Now, what's interesting, really interesting, is I don't want to say altruism because that's more scientific, but goodness. You know, somebody falls on the railroad, on the subway track, and the guy comes and picks the person up, brushes him off, and goes away. Nobody knows who he is. He said he's on his way to work. We have yet to find out who that guy was. And that is kind of, you know, it's good, but it's also instinctive. And that's far more interesting than some brawl in the, you know, in the subway. And I think that our individual yearning for this other kind of person will make all the difference. It doesn't have to be fiat or governmental. I against all knowledge, I think in a way we're moving toward that. Because there's so much war, it looks like, oh God. But I think human beings are moving a little closer to the best selves that we can be.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Last question.
Hello.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here with you this evening. I just have a simple question. Each of your books have been a gift to your readers. And it seems like your writing career has been very selfless. But I'm curious to know, what's been the most personally gratifying part of writing?
The most gratifying personal part? Well, sometimes you just hit the right note, and it's so rewarding. I mean, there's a lot, you know, when I wrote Paradise, I was so impressed with myself. You know, I was talking earlier about making the reader come on in. So the first sentence of Paradise is they shot the white girl first and took their time with the rest and never ever identifying who that white girl was. So I know the reader's going to say, who is this white girl? And look, and I had reviews in which they identified the white girl. And, you know, I had one girl, African-American girl, come up and tell me who it was. And she was right, actually. But I thought, well, either they'll look or they'll forget about it and they'll just read the book. So that kind of, I don't know, manipulation is what it is, which I liked because, you know, it was about something else. It's about racial purity on the one hand in the town and then this, you know, diverse world going on in the convent. You're
welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
Toni Morrison.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you tonight. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. Thank you very much.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Book Store and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.